LA has the largest jail system in the country.
You got people that have been in jail just like one time in their life, can't get nothing because of whatever mistake they made.
I stole some ground turkey because I wanted to feed my family. We was hungry.
Off the Block, stories tracing the path from city block to cell block and back. Find it now at kcrw.com or subscribe on iTunes.
Hi, welcome to Sheer Intelligence. I'm Robert Sheer, and the intelligence comes from our guests. And today we have a really sharp, one of the leading journalists that's dealt with the economy for decades. I knew him when he was working at the LA Times back, I guess it was 76 to 88, looking at your bio, David K. Johnson. He's written a powerful new book. I mean, the only book you really have to read about Donald Trump. A guy he covered for 28 years, and it just destroys him. And the book's available. It's a bestseller. And welcome. How are you?
Well, thank you. Thank you, Bob.
Yeah. My only reservation about the book, and, you know, it's enjoyable reading because, you know, fine, I love to see Donald Trump get skewered, and you really have all the goods on him. But the fact of the matter is, he was able to say on the legal side of the law should be changed. But basically, you describe a lifetime of shenanigans and tax evasions and ripping people off that he basically got away with, right?
Yeah, and I got to tell you, there are a couple of things about Donald Trump I sort of admire, and one of them is his unparalleled capacity to shut down and deflect law enforcement investigations, sometimes with campaign contributions, sometimes by running out the clock, sometimes by ratting out other people to protect himself. But, you know, it's a skill we should wish no one had, but you look at it, you got to say, wow, he is really good at this. Anybody else by now would have had themselves indicted a few times and had other serious problems.
No, well, you know, having also read all of your other books and a lot of your reporting, which earned you a Pulitzer Prize, and you were also a finalist for several of them, it looks to me like these sort of shenanigans are part of the system. You have tax accountants and lawyers, and avoiding taxes is, the great American pastime for large corporations.
Absolutely, Bob. And Donald is a good example of how unevenly and unfairly the laws are written. You know, this recent issue where he says that he paid a $2,500 fine for having given Pam Bondi, the Attorney General of California, a campaign gift of $25,000 from his charitable foundation. That's absolutely illegal. You cannot make a campaign gift from a charitable foundation. He actually still came out ahead on that because presuming he was paying at the top tax rate, I actually think Donald pays nothing, but assuming he was, the deduction for the $25,000 to his foundation was worth $10,000. And he was then fined $2,500. He's still $7,500 ahead, and he's done something illegal. It is astonishing to me that he's not facing revocation of the charitable status and that the attorney general, whose campaign said 3 years ago, we are perfectly comfortable with the contribution from the Donald J. Trump Charitable Foundation, that there weren't actions brought against her because she's a lawyer. She knows this was absolutely improper.
There's no question. You nailed the guy. And, there's no question that there are compelling reasons why Donald Trump is not a great role model, should not be president, cannot be trusted with the country. And I think your book is, as I said before, probably the only thing one needs to read to make that case. I mean, it's devastating. And you, I don't know, 28 years you had kept files and you went to those files and produced this book. And it's giving a great deal of enjoyment to the Clinton crowd, right? Because, you know,
I presume I haven't heard from any of them, but I would assume that they've read it. On the other hand, they have not picked up the issues in my book and used them in the campaign. I mean, here's a man who and this shows how weak the law is. he has a casino license, an incredibly valuable privilege. Nobody has a right. It's a privilege to have a casino. And he risks that license on behalf of this major drug trafficker, big-time drug trafficker. And somehow, mysteriously, the case gets transferred from Cincinnati, Ohio, to Newark, New Jersey, before Judge Marianne Trump Berry, his sister. And I haven't seen anybody pick up on this story. It's thoroughly documented. It's all in the public record. I mean, my goodness, a candidate for president of the United States by a major party who was doing business with and getting his helicopters from this major drug trafficker and pleads successfully for mercy for him. I haven't seen anybody, Clinton surrogates, Clinton herself, say one word about this. And it's like, what?
Well, the book we're talking about is The Making of Donald Trump. It's a bestseller, New York Times bestseller, right out the first week out of the door. And, you know, people should read it. First of all, it's very enjoyable reading to read about a scoundrel and all of the devious things he does and how he gets away with it. But the big $64 question for me is he the outlier or is he the system? Is he just the awkward face of the system? And, you know, you talk about tax evasion, but here you have GE, for example, that has put 2 out of 3 jobs abroad, doesn't pay taxes many years. And yet, you know, Jeffrey Immelt, the head of it, was made the head of Obama's Jobs Council and is rewarded. I mean, what is the main system? What is Goldman Sachs? What is Wall Street? And your other books lay that stuff bare. And in fact, well, interestingly enough, you had a column in the Daily Beast comparing Trump and Hillary Clinton's tax proposals. You know, and there are minor differences, but in the main, they leave in place a tax system that you have devoted your life to exposing and still will be rigged for the super rich.
Donald is a part of a much, much bigger problem of how the game is, in fact, rigged. I mean, a couple of my books have in the subtitle the word rigged. And when Donald Trump says the system is rigged, he's right. He's one of the riggers and the riggy at the same time who benefits from this. But he's an extreme example of it, Bob, for another reason. The things that GE does are, as I called one of my books, perfectly legal. They ought not to be legal, but they are. Trump has done lots of things that are perfectly illegal, and yet he's managed to escape the consequences of that. And this is a man, you know, who's running on a campaign, a campaign built on racism and xenophobia and religious bigotry, who says, the minute I take office, crime in America is going to stop. Now, that's absurd, but his point is that he's going to be incredibly tough on anybody who violates the law. He calls Hillary Clinton a criminal, for example, crooked Hillary Clinton. He should look in the mirror.
Well, I didn't know that quite.
Is just a function of what's wrong with law enforcement. It's focused on blue-collar street crime and not on crime in the suites.
Well, I do think that is a very important takeaway from the making of Donald Trump. And I'm not minimizing the examples you offer. I mean, the fact is the guy's behavior has been outrageous on every count. And for him now, I mean, the idea that he's running for president and leaving aside the neo-fascist rhetoric about immigrants and Muslims and everything, the other and scapegoating, I mean, there's no question. What I'm really getting at, though, is I assume he's going to be defeated. I assume, you know, he'll get something like 30% of the vote. And the Libertarian candidate, Gary Johnson, seems to be mounting a significant campaign of more among conservatives, genuine conservatives. My concern here is we've lost all the Bernie Sanders arguments about fairness in the system, about income inequality, about the crimes of Wall Street that go on unpunished. And so assuming that Trump gets trumped and this goes the way of Barry Goldwater for other reasons. I think Goldwater was far more admirable. Where does that leave us with the Hillary Clinton presidency? And aren't we giving her a pass? And I just want to give one recent example. The Washington Post had an expose this week as we're taping this, beginning of September. And Bill Clinton got $18 million from a guy running, private universities around the world that are subject to a lot of criticism, and you have to plead to other governments. He gets $18 million for shilling for this company, and then arranges a visit with this guy at an important conference at the State Department, where his wife is the Secretary of State. Are we going to lose those concerns in this election?
Well, this is not what's in my book, but let me offer my perspective on it. First of all, I'm not as sanguine as you about this election. I think that Trump may yet get elected. And I think the cynicism about the Clintons can be a real contributor. For all the faults of the Clintons, the fact is that right now, this moment, there are at least 11 million people who are alive, which means lots of children who are not orphans because of the Clintons' charitable initiative. What's Donald Trump done? You can go through the tax returns of his two-bit little foundation to which he's not even the major contributor. And, you know, it's $10,000 to the Police Athletic League and other totally uninspired and strategically for his business-oriented minor gifts. The Clintons, on the other hand, have, while dealing with people you and I and most reasonable people don't like, have put an enormous amount of money into things that have made the world better for incredibly poor people. And the problem I see in Hillary Clinton is that she is, because of the attacks on her over the years, she has developed this hide, tough hide, where she doesn't listen to criticism. She doesn't listen to advice from anybody outside her small circle on political matters. And so she it makes herself vulnerable to all sorts of attacks and claims, you know, that she's a liar. I don't see any more evidence that she's a liar than any other politician out there. Certainly compared to Trump, she's not in his league when it comes to lying. I think the deeper problem, Bob, is that we're going to continue to only have people running for president of the United States who are approved by Wall Street and other big financial centers until we address the most fundamental issue, which is the position of our Supreme Court that dollars and free speech are equals, and they're not. We need discrimination against money in politics and in favor of speech. And until we get that, we're going to continue to have, you know, to channel Will Rogers, you know, the finest Congress and presidents that money can buy.
You know, I just want to raise one point here, which is, you know, yes, you could say the Clinton Foundation does some charitable things. But if we look at the record of Clinton, they put through radical deregulation under Bill Clinton,
yep.
That the Republicans couldn't pull off. And
right.
you know all about the Commodity Futures Modernization Act,
right.
The Financial Reserve. Okay. And you look at the stats, black and brown college graduates lost 70% of their wealth, not their income, their wealth, according to the Federal Reserve of St. Louis. Why? Because they were the targeted group. College graduates who were black and brown, who managed to get through college. So I'm just wondering, you know, if Trump was the Manchurian candidate invented by the Democratic Party establishment, he'd be perfect, you know, because it just wiped out all of those issues that Bernie Sanders was raising. And you even have somebody like Paul Krugman, you know, who has been a very good critic and thinker in the New York Times. Now, you know, he even tells us, oh, there's nothing wrong with Glass-Steagall and Bernie Sanders was wrong. Well, that's not true. Goldman Sachs, because of the reversal of Glass-Steagall, was able to declare itself a commercial bank and get all sorts of funding, right? And
right.
Isn't there some danger in giving this Democratic Party leadership, you know, Podesta and everybody else a pass?
Yeah. I mean, you know, my brother, who's a disabled manual laborer, he was the guy clearing the tree out of the culvert so you could get to work in this rainstorm, says to me, you know, what have the Democrats done for people like me? And I'd be a Republican if any of the following were true, if I hated gay people, if I believed in God, or if I loved guns. I don't. But what in the hell have Democrats done for me? They're like light beer. They're Republican light. And that's what the campaign finance system has done. If Hillary Clinton is the next president, I think you're going to see she'll be pretty clearly she'll be hawkish, but she's not going to go out of her way to increase the size of the army by a fifth, as Donald Trump has just proposed, and use nuclear weapons, you're probably going to see a strengthening of the position of Elizabeth Warren and her efforts to limit abuses of consumers in consumer finance. I don't think you'll see, however, any toughness on the bigger games that Wall Street plays with public finance, junk bonds, and I don't mean in the sense of high rate bonds. I mean useless bonds they've sold to local governments and things like that. I don't think you're going to see her rein in that. And you will see a determined effort to improve the conditions of poor children. If there's one constant in Hillary Clinton's life, it is that she has worked to get better education and better health care for little children.
I don't want to take up a lot of time in this interview because, you know, I get other opportunities to discuss it. But 70% of the people on welfare were children, and that basic federal program was ended. So I just want to throw that in as a footnote.
Yes, absolutely. And ending welfare as we know it and developing this thing called TANF was, I think, a major mistake. And I think Bill Clinton, you know, bought into a lot of Republican rhetoric and his wife publicly supported him. But I don't think that's what we'll see with her in those areas. I mean, remember when she found out that she was no match for the insurance industry and the health initiative went down, she immediately turned around and got CHIP. And that put 8 million children who didn't have health care into a position to get health care. And, you know, she's got lots of problems as a candidate, but compared to the Republican nominee, she's clearly the vastly better qualified and more emotionally stable person to do the job, flaws and all.
Okay. And then we've got that testimonial, and we'll remind you of that, you know, a year or two from now.
Okay.
See how happy you are. But no, you're not alone, you know. You got Tom Hayden and Todd Gitlin and a lot of folks out there who were backing Hillary even when Bernie Sanders was still in the race. And my interest, and this
is— Listen, I'm not backing anybody here. I'm a registered Republican,
okay,
Bob.
Okay. No, I'm just talking about as a journalistic question, because you wrote something very impressive at the time of the banking bailout in a letter to Romanesca, and it's in the Wikipedia pages on you. I didn't do heavy research, but it was quite moving to me. You wrote and said, let's not be quick to bail out the banks. Let's not panic. And journalists should not be lapdogs, paraphrasing what you said, but the lapdogs the way they were in supporting the Iraq War and supporting the Patriot Act. And they should raise some real questions about throwing all this money at Wall Street. Well, Barack Obama came in. Two things are often forgotten by liberals. One, it was John McCain who was still willing to do a public financing of campaigns for all the talk about Citizens United and everything. And it was Barack Obama who went to Wall Street and got all that big money. Now you have a situation where Hillary Clinton is clearly the favored candidate of Wall Street. She's there in the Hamptons. And the New York Times had an article, about how the press can't get to her. She doesn't have press conferences. She doesn't even meet with the public. She's doing all this fundraising. So if we're going to talk about big money in politics, it seems that the Democrats, Robert Rubin, who was head of Goldman Sachs and became Secretary of Treasury and then did the Wall Street bidding, they've learned how to play to the Wall Street crowd. It's not just the Koch brothers out there. And I do fear that journalists are doing the very thing that you warned against, that they're panicking.
Well, I think that without question, what's happened with the Democrats is really revealing about what's gone wrong with our democracy in America. I mean, one of the reasons that I dropped everything to write The Making of Donald Trump is that I think our democracy is in very deep trouble. We've seen a major breakdown in the ethics of the big law firms and the accounting firms and the top managers of companies. We've seen the rise of a phenomena first described by Bill Black, who was a bank regulator in San Francisco, became the guy responsible for more than 3,000 indictments of bankers in the SNL scandal, and more than 880 high-level bankers actually went to jail because of his work. And he calls it control fraud. That's where you get control of a company and you then run it as a fraud to maximize your own gains and leave the carcass behind to the public. And we saw this in the collapse on Wall Street, where Countrywide, which was writing a fifth of all the mortgages in America, was basically a fraud, and yet the federal government didn't prosecute him. We saw Barack Obama and Eric Holder refuse to go after the big bankers, and Holder lie for 10 months that they were going after the big bankers. And I can say lie because we now have documents that show he was told what he was saying wasn't true and he kept doing it. And they had this specious argument that, well, these things that, this, as Barack Obama told 60 Minutes, these things the bankers did, they appear awful, but they're not illegal. You know what? Fraud is a crime everywhere and always. And had they called up Bill Black and said, show us how to get these guys convicted, we'd have thousands of Wall Street bankers at every level, from CEO down to people selling stuff, behind bars, at least for a brief period of time, and major reform. But nobody would speak to Bill Black, and nobody is listening to those things. And the journalism community has been so decimated. I mean, you know, there were 50% more journalists in this country in 2000 than there are now, that the tough questions aren't being asked, and many of the journalists who understand things on a deep level are gone. So what you have is the parroting of stuff, and this is not good for our democracy at all. But when you come to the two choices you have here, because you really got one or the other, Trump or Clinton is going to be elected, you have one person who the prospect of him having his finger on the nuclear codes should make all of us scream. And the other candidate, flaws and all, at least falls within the mainstream of the corrupt system we've had for the last 40 years.
Okay, so that's a hell of an endorsement.
Someday, Bob, if I live long enough, I'm going to get to vote for somebody for president who I want to see in the White House.
Okay, now you got
hasn't happened yet.
Okay, I don't want to take attention away from your book. You mentioned Countrywide and Angelo Mozzillo and so forth, and we cannot forget that they were brought into Fannie Mae by a Democrat.
Yep.
Right.
Yep.
A guy who'd worked for, a guy Johnson who worked for Mondale, and they brought him in, and Countrywide was able to rewrite the rules about what are conforming loans. And
exactly.
And that's what made all of this possible. So we can't blame this whole housing scam on Republicans. Sure, most of them who were, with the exception of a few libertarians, were cheering it on, Phil Graham and everything, and went to work for UBS after. But none of this could have happened without the Democrats.
Bob, I think, Bob, that there is plenty of blame here to go around about it and what's gone wrong with our system. But, at the heart of it, the problem is there are a couple of fundamental problems in our society. One of them is that big companies have figured out that it's easier to make or enhance their profits by mining the treasury than earning them in the marketplace. That's what my book Free Lunch was about. That's really damaging our economy. Another is that we stopped adding additional House members in 1920. If we had the Congress that was proposed in the original Bill of Rights, which had 12 amendments, not 10, today Congress would have over 6,000 members, and you'd be able to get your congressperson on the phone. Instead, it's only big donors who can get their congressperson on the phone quickly, if at all. And we have created a system in which our democracy is focused on something the Constitution doesn't talk about. We have six noble purposes for this country. They're in the preamble to the Constitution: more perfect union, established justice, domestic tranquility, common defense, justice, most of all, and then promoting the general welfare. But instead, we have a Congress that's focused on serving the economic interests of artificial persons, non-natural persons, corporations, because they're the dominant culture in America. And this is very troubling. And I have to tell you, I think that if we don't recognize that our democracy is in trouble and that personality politics, which is what allowed Donald Trump to rise, if we don't recognize this fundamental problem of personality politics, we're going to just continue down the road where a narrow group of wealthy Americans, not all wealthy Americans, but a group within it, are going to continue to line their pockets and drain ours.
Let me ask you, we only have a few minutes, and I'd just like to ask you about what's happened to journalism. When we were both at the Los Angeles Times, we were able to exploit what I call the contradictions of the system. Mm-hmm. There were different papers competing, and the LA Times was competing with the New York Times, which was starting to become more of a national paper, and the Washington Post, and the people we work for, you know, Bill Thomas and eventually Tom Johnson and others, wanted to be competitive. And there were these, as I say, contradictions. Now, the entire media seems to be owned, despite the wonders of the internet. The major media seems to be owned by a few players who are actually responding to big money all the time.
Well, Ben Bagdikian, who died recently's book, Media Monopoly, continues to be the best source on what's happened here. You and I started out at a time when there were lots of competing newspapers. In the Bay Area, where I worked for the San Jose Mercury, starting when I was as a front page reporter and as 19 years old, had papers in every town around the Bay Area, for example. And now every paper in the Bay Area except one daily paper is owned by a single group. Run by a guy who doesn't care about anybody, his profits, and the other one is the San Francisco Chronicle, which is a shell of itself. I remember having a shouting argument with Ed Meese when he was Attorney General of the United States. And when it was all done, you know, we shook hands and we walked away, but we had really strong words with each other one day. I once said to a three-star general, General, stop lying to the Los Angeles Times. If you don't want to answer my question, just don't answer. But if you lie one more time, every junior officer in the U.S. Army is going to know you're a lying son of a bitch. You would get fired today for doing that. You would absolutely be fired. In fact, a reporter I know who spoke up at a Bush White House briefing and said, by your own standards, this briefing should be on the record. Not one other reporter would support him. And he went around and asked him why. And they all said, because we'll get fired. The news organizations are no longer feared and respected. And this 40-year campaign, Can't Trust the Liberal Media, has had a big impact. I mean, every day I see somewhere somebody saying, oh, the New York Times is just full of opinions. And I often send somebody like that a copy of a story and say, well, here's a story from today's front page. Please show me the opinion so I can call it out. We've been cowed, and very successfully cowed. And the focus on television and the decline in newspaper readership and the decline in the quality of debate in America, they're all bad for our democracy. And one of the reasons, Bob, I thought it was really important to do the making of Donald Trump is that I knew nobody else was going to tell people about all of his criminal associations, all of his swindling of people, all of his dealing with violent felons for profit, and his cruelty to individual people, from the mother of his children to the baby whose life he put in danger to make money. And it's a terrible indictment of what's happened to the press in America, and we need to fix that. But right now, I think we need to be focused on that we have this totally unqualified fellow who may be the next president of the United States and who openly talks about using nuclear weapons in Europe.
The making of Donald Trump really lets you in on just what a conniving, unprincipled character Donald Trump has, and how I would argue the broader point is he's just the tip of the iceberg of the corruption of what the American capitalist system, the crony capitalism at this stage of the game. And probably the most devastating thing Trump has said is during the debates when he said, hey, you're all on the take. Let's conclude to examine that point. What is the difference between Trump and the other corrupt players in the American economic system on the highest level?
Oh, that's very easy, actually. And I'll go back to Calvin Coolidge for the example. Calvin Coolidge was surrounded by businessmen who did corrupt things, but they were basically businessmen. Donald Trump is surrounded by criminals who owned businesses. That's very different. The people Donald Trump is around break legs. They kill people. They deal drugs. They have businesses. They may own car dealerships, helicopter management companies. But they are at heart criminals who have businesses, not dishonest businessmen. That's a really significant shift. And that should really bother people. And I will tell you, I've talked to some reporters who they don't get that distinction, Bob. They can't see the difference between a criminal who has a business and a business person who does things that are dishonest.
That's a pretty strong charge. Can you give just, let's just end with a few examples from your
book?
Well,
sure. Well, first of all, I mentioned the helicopters. Donald Trump got his helicopters from this major drug trafficker whose case was handled in a very strange fashion. There used to be Trump limousines, and those Trump limousines were customized by a man law enforcement reports describe as a soldier in the Genovese crime family, who's also a car dealer worth hundreds of millions of dollars. He traveled all over America doing real estate development deals, and his children were in Moscow with a man named Felix Sater, who served time for shoving the broken stem of a margarita glass into a guy's face so badly he'll never recover. It took 110 stitches, and who later ran a $40 million stock swindle for four New York mafia families. And yet, despite traveling with him all over the place, and I've got photographs and videos of him, he told AP, "I don't know the guy. I mean, I've seen him, but I wouldn't recognize him if he came in the room." And everybody in the news media has accepted this claim, even though the guy himself has since said, "Oh, yeah, well, Donald and I, my office was just down the hall from his, and we talked all the time. We traveled all the time. We did all these business deals together." This man's a really vicious, convicted felon who got a get-out-of-jail card free because he supposedly helped the CIA intercept a bunch of missiles on their way to terrorists in Russia or former parts of the old Soviet Union. Now, you know, the obvious question when someone can do that is, how would you have the connections and know how to intercept missiles on their way to terrorists? What business are you in that would give you those connections and that kind of knowledge? And by the way, if you grabbed 12 missiles for us, how do we not know you kept another 12 for yourself to resell?
Last question, and really it's a statement. This show, this podcast series I'm doing with people I call American Originals, out of the crazy quilt of American culture, we produce people that are actually quite heroic and interesting, and certainly you're a role model for journalists. And I was wondering if you just a personal note, because you've taken real risks. You've had your life threatened. You took on the police department of Los Angeles at one when I first learned of your work. You went and captured, got somebody convicted to free a man on in prison because they had the wrong person. And you know, right now you're making some very strong charges about people who can be quite threatening and frightening. And so what makes you tick? I noticed, by the way, you have 8 children and 5 grandchildren. You live in upstate New York. I mean, who are you? And what gives you the courage and the energy and the enthusiasm to carry on? Is there a short answer that we conclude with on this?
Yeah. Sure. I mean, I got hired as a teenager as a reporter at the San Jose Mercury because it was a way out of poverty. I could have done a lot of other things. If I hadn't been born poor, I probably would have wasted my life being a lawyer or a professor. Journalism was a way to tell stories that weren't being told unless I told them. I was never interested in being in the herd or being part of a press conference. I wanted to tell you something where when you got through reading my work, you'd say, "Boy, I didn't know that. I never knew anything like that." And so I have very deeply studied, you know, how government institutions work, accounting, law. That's why, well, I don't have a college degree. I have enough college credits for at least one master's, maybe two. I teach in a law school because of my deep knowledge of these things. And all of that's motivated by I want to make America a better place when I die than when I was born.
That's simple and profound, and what the American experiment is supposed to be all about, the constitutional experiment. That's it for Sheer Intelligence. Our guest has been David K. Johnson, a legendary investigative journalist, mostly about the economy. The book is The Making of Donald Trump. It's a bestseller, and it's a very, very important book for everyone to read for this election. Our producers are Joshua Scheer and Rebecca Mooney. Technicians here and engineers at KCRW are Kat Yore and Mario Diaz. Thank you once again. See you next week.